Have you ever stopped to notice how many things you do in a single day? No, not the number of things you check off in your to-do list, but the number of behaviors. It's a pretty big number. And what's interesting is much of it's done on autopilot. Around 40%, according to research, of our behaviors are habitual. And our habits are essential. They help keep us on track. But if you stop and think about it, there's a lot of power in those small acts we take each and every day. And if we're more mindful about these actions, when we focus on the precise way that they're performed, some of these habits can instead become rituals. I'm Joe Casey, and this is the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. And our guest today will be talking with us about how to shift from a habit mindset to a ritual mindset and how that can bring more purpose and meaning to your lives. Michael Norton has studied human behavior at the Harvard Business School as it relates to love and inequality, time and money, and happiness and grief. He's the author of the new book, The Ritual Effect: From Habit to Ritual, Harness the Surprising Power of Everyday Actions. He's also the co-author with Elizabeth Dunn of Happy Money: The Science of Happier Spending. In 2012, Michael Norton was selected by Wired Magazine as one of 50 people who will change the world. And his TEDx talk, How to Buy Happiness, has been viewed nearly 4.5 million times. He's a frequent contributor to publications like The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Scientific American, has made numerous television, radio, and podcast appearances. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Joe.
So what led you to research rituals?
Sometimes when you're a scientist, you find you're looking at the world and suddenly things strike you as they're everywhere. And this is for sure something that happened with rituals, where I think I used to think of them as like people in robes with candles chanting hundreds of years ago or something like that. And then when you start to look at everyday life, you know, even birthday cakes and clinking glasses and saying cheers, you know, and weddings and funerals, it really is everywhere in our lives that we use rituals. And that really got me started on it from the very beginning, which is just, it's not just that we use them in one domain of life. We use them all over the place in our lives. And for me, it really hit home when my wife and I had our daughter. And if you've ever brought a baby home, you know, it's a little stressful. And we were trying to get her to sleep. And so what did we do? What all parents did, we didn't think of it as a ritual at the time, but in retrospect, we completely created a ritual out of nothing. This book, this stuffed animal, this song, then this. And that, all of a sudden, I realized I'm not just studying these, they're me. And that opened it up even more. Like, my gosh, they're really all over the place in my life and elsewhere.
And what's the difference between rituals and habits?
It's a tough question. It's a very, in some ways, a very subtle distinction, especially when they're closely linked. So some rituals are definitely not habits. Like, we don't typically make a habit out of weddings. Hopefully we don't have that many in our life, for example. So we're not like trying to have a wedding every morning at 6 a.m. kind of thing. But there are these cases in life where habits are close to rituals, I think. And that's where we kind of have to dive a little deeper to figure out the difference. And I think about habits as the thing that you're trying to get done, the task itself. And rituals are often the other meaning that you bring to it. So talking to some athletes the other day, literally about how they tie their shoes before they perform. And they all have their own way of tying their shoes. The habit is, before a race, I have to tie my shoes or they'll fall off. But that would mean you could tie them any way you want, right? As long as they're tied, you're fine. And these athletes said, absolutely not. What I need to do is put this shoe on first and then do this, then double knot. And then I do the other one, I do this. And if I say, will you do it in the other order? They say, no, absolutely not. So it's beyond it, you know, it's not just the habit. There's some, they feel like, you know, when I tie them the way I tie them, I'm ready to perform. I'm ready for the race. I'm ready for the game. And that, when you get that meaning and emotion, even in silly little things like tying our shoelaces, that to me is when they start to move from just a dry habit to something a bit richer and more interesting and a little bit more ritualistic.
I'll be paying much more attention to tying my shoes tonight before my workout. I thought immediately of just taking free throws in basketball. You know, the routine you go through before you shoot, you do it always the same exact way.
And everybody has their own. If you watch the NBA, it's no two players are alike. It's very interesting.
So what are the different ways that rituals help us?
I think one thing that I like about rituals is that they're a bit domain general, in the sense that we don't, again, just use them in one domain. So imagine the only thing we use rituals for was to tie our shoes before a big race or to try to calm down before a big event. We for sure use them there, but then we use them in all these other domains of life as well. We use them in our marriages. We use them with our kids and families. We use them at work. So we really think about this idea of rituals allow us across many domains of life to change our experience in one way or another. We're often looking for an emotion when we engage in rituals. Like if I'm doing something with my wife that we do, you know, date night, we're doing the ritual in order to feel closer. If I'm tying my shoes, I'm doing it in order to feel calmer. So we have these ways of using rituals to try to get us to an emotion that we think at least would be helpful in that moment.
So there's really an intentionality about these.
Very often people will say, I always take time to do this thing. And they really do. You have to leave the time. If you've got a big pre-performance ritual, or like Rafael Nadal, when he serves a tennis ball, it's like a 7,000 step thing that he does before every serve. He's got to leave enough time. You know, he's got to start it before he runs out of time to serve. And so we do have to, in a sense, make room for them in our lives in order to enact them the way we want to.
You're bringing up lots of visual images of baseball players adjusting their gloves. Well, before last year, it took longer before they stepped into the box. So when you read books, there's usually things that jump out to you. And your phrasing of making the mundane meaningful stood out to me. What examples of rituals do you have in your own life that you can share that do that for you?
It's so interesting to see how everyone, but including me, takes the silliest little things in life and turns them into something more than that. There was a couple in our research where they said every time before they ate, they clanked their silverware together, which is, there's nothing more boring than a fork. I mean, a fork is just the thing we use to put food in our mouth, but they turned a fork into a cute thing that they did before every single meal. You know, we've always done it. We're always going to do it. We can use a fork to create something like that. And I think we often use rituals to enliven really boring things. In my family, we were trying to get my daughter to eat meatloaf one time. And my wife had the brilliant idea to put birthday candles in the meatloaf, light them, and sing happy meatloaf to you to see if we could jazz up, you know, take the birthday cake ritual, move it over to meatloaf and see if we could pull that off and see if she would eat it. Again, it's just candles. You know, they don't have any meaning in themselves, but we can bring meaning to them and change cake or meatloaf or whatever else into something more than that.
I can see that coming soon to broccoli.
For sure. Brussels sprouts, another perennial problem. Yeah.
So how do rituals enhance relationships?
If you ask couples, we usually don't say, do you have a ritual? Because people think of the people in robes with candles. So that's not what we mean. But if we say, you know, do you and your partner have something that you do regularly? You make sure to do it and it feels special to you and it feels unique from other couples. From across studies, about 2/3 to 3/4 of couples say, yes, we do have something that we do. And they're very, very different from each other. The clinking forks was one that I loved. Another couple said, we always kiss in threes. They can't, if they do twice, they have to do the third and they'll never go past three. Of course, other couples would do two, you know, or kiss on one cheek, kiss on both cheeks. You know, we have all these different ways of thinking about this. But what we find is that couples who say they have one of these special rituals report being more satisfied in their relationships than couples who tell us they don't have one of these. And so we do see this difference where having a ritual is linked to having a more satisfied relationship. And if we see a relationship that lacks one, it's a signal in the data that perhaps that couple is less satisfied.
And are there any other examples that you found in the research or many stories in the book that are great that you'd highlight, ones that surprised you or that you found particularly interesting?
For couples in particular or in general?
Just in general.
There are so many. I think one that always stands out to me, it's a sad one, but it's so telling and so poignant, which is we have also asked people, think of someone who you lost. And we say, again, is there something that you did to honor that person that reflected your relationship uniquely? And again, many, many people say, yes, they will say, well, there was a funeral. You know, I went to a funeral, but I also did this other thing. And one person wrote, I washed his car every weekend the way he used to do. And we don't have any more information than that, but you know exactly what is happening in that person's life, which is their loved one obviously had a car that they love. This person decided, they didn't say they drive the car, right? Car just stays where it is, but they take over the care of the car because they can't care for the person anymore. And we see so many little rituals like that that people come up with that are, there's no 2,000-year-old text that says, wash the car. For one thing, there's no cars, right? So we make them up ourselves often, but you can see how meaningful they are to people when they really follow through on them.
So one question I'm sure you get often is about morning routines. What's the best morning routine? And we're all different, so I'm sure one size won't fit all. But what advice would you offer someone listening on how to create a morning routine that they find meaningful?
There's no correct way. So we've even looked at something as simple as, do you brush your teeth first and then shower? Or do you shower and then brush your teeth? And about half of people do one way and half of people do the other. There's some people who are like, I do them at the same time, but I don't, that's not okay in my mind. No, do whatever you want. But interestingly, half of people do it one way, shower, then brush their teeth, and the other half brush their teeth and then shower. And we don't see that one of those orders is more or less important, you know, or works better. But what we do see is that some people, if we say, hey, tomorrow morning, will you switch the order? You usually brush your teeth and then shower. Tomorrow morning, would you mind flipping the order? And about half of people say, sure, no problem. But half of people say, no, I don't want to. And they say things like, I'd feel off. I wouldn't feel ready for the day. And what that means is they've taken that, these incredibly simple things, showering and brushing your teeth, and turned them into a morning ritual. They make sure to do them the same way every single day. If we ask how long you've been doing it that way, they don't even know. It feels like they've been doing it forever, and they're going to keep doing it forever. And when they do it in the way they like to do it, they do feel ready for their day. So it isn't so much that it would be interesting if we had discovered in our research that, imagine that showering and then brushing always was better for some reason, then I would say shower first and brush second. But it seems to be we create ourselves in our own distinct way. And then if you enact them repeatedly, that seems to be where people start to say, then when I do it, I really get this good feeling of being ready.
It's one of those where you really can't imagine the other way.
People will say, what kind of a person could get in the shower without brushing their teeth? You know, I mean, it's a very strong reaction sometimes.
So I found your chapter on rites of passage very interesting. And it reminded me of a story that I read in Richard Rohr's book, Falling Upward, one of the best titles of all time. Okay.
Great.
And it was about Japan creating a ceremony for Japanese soldiers returning from the war to really help them make the transition back to society. Because prior to having a ceremony, having a ritual, they were felt adrift. How could rituals help people transition into retirement and mark that rite of passage, particularly because you write about do-it-yourself rituals?
It's so interesting in the research, because what you see is that we're very good at creating rituals when people start things. So when you enter the military, every single culture has a very long training program that you go through in order to become a soldier. When you enter a prison, there's a real process to have you move from being who you were to being a prisoner. But we're not as good always at coming out the other end to say, well, what about when you leave prison? What are we doing? Or what about when you return from war? What are we doing to help you transition back? And sometimes we discover them and sometimes we don't. And I think that's important because, you know, if you think about hiring someone, we have a word, onboarding. It's literally a word. And we only use it to say when somebody new starts, they got to go through this thing and then they're an employee. And then at the end, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, we should get a cake for them. It's their last day. And then see you later. And that's often not that satisfying for people when they're finishing their job. I find it very unusual that when we have retirement ceremonies, that's when everyone who knows the person stands up and says, thank you. You know, you made a huge difference in my life. I'm so grateful to you. And then they never see them again because the person's job is over and they move. And so I do think a lot about why do we wait until the transition is just about to happen rather than start things earlier, start celebrations earlier, and help people transition a little bit better. And I think that can help us then have a better demarcation between what we were and what we're going to be. I was a full-time employee. I was a parent. Now I'm retired, or now I'm an empty nester. How are we helping people transition from one to the other, because it's a huge transition when we go through any of these transitions in life.
Another thing you write about in the ritual effect is the IKEA effect, and that we tend to value the homemade rituals we create ourselves, perhaps more than the ones we inherit, the legacy rituals, as you call them. What advice would you offer people listening how to create new rituals?
We have, when we look at rituals, there's many different types, but just two broad categories are rituals that we receive or inherit. They could be family rituals, they could be cultural rituals, they could be religious rituals that we get from our parents, from our grandparents, from our faith. And those rituals play an enormously important role in our lives. And we know what they are, and we know how meaningful they are when we do them. You know, weddings and funerals exist for a reason. We bring everybody together who cares about these people, in one case to kind of send them off as a couple, in the other case so that we can all say goodbye and grieve together. So these kind that we kind of already constructed are so important and so meaningful for us. And yet also what we see people doing is coming up with their own all the time. You could imagine that all we do are the ones that we've received, and we don't sort of freelance our own rituals. And instead, we see people pulling from both. They do some inherited, and they do some that they create themselves. And I think clinking silverware, any of these sorts of things that people keep washing a car, that people come up with themselves, no one said, hey, use forks, or hey, use a car. It's we can bring meaning to them ourselves. And in our own research, we do show, as you said, that even if we assemble products ourselves, if I put it together myself, if I make a bookcase myself, I'm going to like it a lot more than the same bookcase that you put together, because I poured myself into it. It's a reflection of me. And a little bit the same logic applies with rituals, that for sure, the ones we inherit are incredibly meaningful. And there's something different also about pouring myself into it and coming up with my own.
So it's that meaning and emotion that you talked about earlier that really can make the difference.
For sure.
And any last word that you'd like to add on the book about rituals, about how they can really help people enhance their lives?
I think the last thing that anybody wants to hear is add 10 more things to your life. That's just not a good selling point. You know, if I said, it's very helpful to meditate for 5 hours every day. Well, that's great, but who has time to meditate for 5 hours every day? I often think about it less as think about adding a whole bunch of rituals all over the place, and instead starting just actually looking at your current behavior, kind of taking an inventory of what you currently do. Do you have something that you do in the morning? You know, is it always coffee and then newspaper and then chat with and then dog? Or are you all over the place? And those are places where you can start to see that sometimes you're doing things already that have some of these properties. And by the way, if you don't think you have any rituals, ask your spouse, ask your children, ask your coworkers. They'll be very happy to tell you all the quirky things that you do. And I like that idea of starting there, of just kind of already recognizing this role that they play in our lives.
Great place to start. Take an inventory, get some outside advice and observations from people who know you well and can point those out. Michael, thank you so much for sharing all this information on your research and wisdom on rituals.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Time for the takeaway segment. A few actionable ideas from today's conversation with Michael Norton. Number one, is it time to take inventory? So what are your habits and rituals? I think this is a great idea to get a handle on what's in place today. What are some things that you may not be aware of that you could be more intentional of? And step back and take stock of the importance of rituals in your life and identify what are some habits that you could, with a bit more mindfulness, turn into rituals. Number two, what should your list look like going forward? I think his distinction between inherited rituals and do-it-yourself rituals was very interesting. And also his comment about you don't want to add 10 new things to your list, but when you look at your inventory, are there some new things you could add? Are there some things that it's time to let go of? What changes will you make going forward? Number three, how will you celebrate your retirement and within your retirement? I think we've lost touch with rituals that help us mark one phase of life for another in many respects around careers. And I think it's worth considering how you'll mark your transition from one phase of life into this new phase of life once you do graduate. From one to the other, and then what role will rituals play in this new phase of life for you? Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. The mission here is to help you retire smarter by focusing on not only the financial side of retirement, but the non-financial side. So you can bring some imagination to your retirement. Retirement is not just a left brain thing that's quantitative in its planning. You want to bring some right brain things, some imagination to your retirement as well. Thanks for listening.